And on RN Summer, this is Great Lovers, the story of romance in the Western world. Hello, I'm Amanda Smith. And over this series, Great Lovers features some of our favourite and most enduring love stories, historical and fictional accounts of lovers whose tales have been told and retold generation after generation. Along the way, charting the course of true love, which, as you know, never did run smooth, and to try to work out why all our juiciest love stories are tragedies, when surely the ideal is to fall in love and live happily ever after. Today's lovers are Dido and Aeneas, Antony and Cleopatra, and Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton.
All that I shall ever want to hold, or look upon, or be, or have, is here now with you.
Remember, remember. I want you to forget me, please.
Forget? How? I can never be more far away from you than this.
So why is love and romance, in its ecstasies and its agonies, such a dominant theme of art and of life? Well, for a start, is there any better feeling than falling in love?
Love is the source of all value. Without you, life would be meaningless, life would be empty, nothing would be significant. It feels like you are meeting the very best person who's ever lived. And not only are you meeting them, but hang on, they love you back and they think of you in the same kind of way. Now, it's not at all surprising that that should stand as one of the great moments, the great ideals of existence. And I think that's why it's come to seem so important. That's an image of, in a way, what we would like the whole of life to be like. So love then stands as the kind of lamp that illuminates the whole of life, and I think this is the core of the romantic conception of love.
Well, before we get completely carried away, let's get unromantic for just a moment. Is love, in the way you think about it and the way you experience it, a universally acknowledged truth? Mary Evans is the author of Love, an Unromantic Discussion.
In many societies, and indeed across societies across time, the idea of love differs enormously. Some societies, in point of fact, don't actually have words for love. And that missing word, I think, should make us think about the way in which something we take absolutely for granted in the West is actually something which is not natural, but is social. So by constructed, I mean that our culture has put together this idea. And because cultures change, so our ideas about love change as well.
And in the course of this series, we'll chart some of those changing ideas about love in the Western world. For example, in Athens, the birthplace of Western culture, the ancient Greeks had their very own version of the bachelor, according to philosopher John Armstrong.
The Greeks told this fantastic story that right back at the beginning of human life, we were actually composite people. We were joined, pairs of people were joined, I suppose, around the middle, and they had four legs and four arms, two backs and two heads. But these composite characters were really uppity and always kind of making fun of the gods, and Zeus, the head of the gods, the king of the gods, got really cross and said, right, I'm going to split you down the middle to make you less powerful and less arrogant, and adding that, you know, and if you don't keep quiet, I'll split you again, you can hop about on one leg. But anyway, the point was that the Greeks had this story which told them that we used to be joined to another person and now we were separated, and they saw love as the desire to get back to the bit you'd been split off from. So they had this very seductive image that there was another person out there who was the perfect fit for you, and that once you got together with that person, you'd be made whole again, it would be perfect for both sides. You see, the other person would want you just as much as you wanted them. They'd be right for you and you'd be right for them. And after that, you'd have no more loose ends, no stray bits, so you'd never want anyone else. You'd be completely happy for the rest of your life.
Well, that Greek myth of the origin of love is recounted in Plato's Symposium. It's really a story for men only. When ancient Greeks talked about love, they were pretty well exclusively talking about homosexual love. The Romans had a different view of love. Actually, they didn't think that much of love at all, at least not in any kind of romantic sense. But it is from a key point in Roman history that we get the first pair of great lovers in this series. They've been called history's most extravagant lovers. They were famous in the Mediterranean world of the 1st century BC, but it took a 16th century Englishman by the name of William Shakespeare to truly elevate them to great lover status. They are Antony and Cleopatra.
If it be love indeed, then tell me how much.
There's beggary in the love that can be reckoned.
Later in this program, you'll get a sense of what Roman contemporaries thought of Antony and Cleopatra, as well as another pair of lovers from Roman literature, Dido and Aeneas. Plus 20th century Hollywood's Antony and Cleopatra, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, whose real lives imitated the legendary lovers they played on the big screen. First, though, to Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. The setting is the turmoil in Rome following the assassination of Julius Caesar. While Mark Antony is a key political player, he falls in love with the Queen of Egypt. It's an affair that's fatal for both of them, and that allows Antony's political rival Octavius to take power in Rome as Augustus Caesar. But is it a fatal mistake because Antony and Cleopatra are so deeply in love with each other, or is this just a crazy, destructive infatuation? John Bell, the founder of the Bell Shakespeare Company.
I find love in this play very hard to define. What is the nature of love? It's certainly a grand passion. Whether or not that amounts to true love is rather harder to say. I think that's what Shakespeare is throwing at us. Is this love? Is it lust? Is it passion? Is it long-lasting? Is it short-lived? What is the nature of love?
Well, if Shakespeare keeps us guessing about just what it is that Antony and Cleopatra feel for each other, what about their motivations? Are they driven by some kind of love or by ambition and by the allure of each other's power?
Shakespeare was being very conscious of his historical sources and stuck to them pretty rigorously in terms of the things that happened, I guess because he knew his audience was very well educated and would know the historical facts and dates and, you know, names of generals and battles and things, so he didn't want to get anything wrong in case they sort of, threw something at the actors. So he was very conscious of his sources. At the same time, he was inventing the psychology of these characters. And that's where we get a certain conflict, I suppose, between what actually happened historically and why it happened, or what motivated these people. Now, historically, one could say that Cleopatra may have been far more ambitious and pragmatic than Shakespeare makes her, that she may have had affairs with Julius Caesar, then with Antony, and tried to get it off with Octavius as well, in order to preserve her empire and her family. In Shakespeare's play, it's more ambivalent. She seems to have a tremendous affection for both Julius Caesar and for Antony, and she does try and get off with Octavius towards the end, but that's simply a ruse, I think, in terms of self-preservation. So her motives are very mixed.
Age cannot wither her, nor custom stale her infinite variety. Other women cloy the appetites they feed, but she makes hungry where most she satisfies. For vilest things become themselves in her, that the holy priests bless her when she is riggish.
In Antony's case, of course, it's the opposite. He throws away all ambition. He throws away everything in his passion for Cleopatra. So he's certainly a lost cause in terms of, a successful career move.
Let Rome in Tiber melt and the wide arch of the ranged empire fall. Here is my space.
So is it in their flaws and excesses and appetites, certainly more than any kind of moral courage, that Antony and Cleopatra are such vivid and intriguing characters?
I think on the one hand we can disapprove or condemn some of the things they do. Their extravagance, their treachery, their mindlessness in the way they squander their opportunities and their empires. There's a lot you can sort of, a lot of blame you can lay at their door if you want. But at the same time I think the size of their passion, their generosity of spirit, their imagination, their sheer enjoyment of life is totally infectious and we can admire that. And so they are grand figures, and when they die, we are left with that cold fish Octavius and a very pragmatic, cold sort of Roman autocracy that is far less preferable to the kind of extravagant fantasy we've just seen in the lives of Antony and Cleopatra. I think to Shakespeare, the Romans represent all that is repressive and moralistic and opportunistic and unimaginative. That is the male society, whereas Egypt is the female. It's the river. It's fertility. It's the serpent, the snake. It's woman. It's the other. It's oriental, and therefore the male has to destroy that, has to tame it, has to have it under his foot, as it were. So I think that gender conflict is very strong in the play too.
And in the end, with Antony and Cleopatra dead, and Octavius as Caesar, the universal landlord, triumphant, does the play then really force us to a view that it is the cool, dispassionate ones, not the lovers, who inherit the earth?
I think that's Shakespeare's unhappy conclusion through most of his plays. If you look at the end of Macbeth, we get Malcolm, who is a rather Machiavellian and opportunistic, deceitful character who takes over. At the end of Hamlet, you get Fortinbras coming in and taking over. All cold-eyed, pragmatic young men without much passion, without much blood flowing through their veins. It's the people of big imagination, big passion, who are wiped out. And it's the cold pragmatists who inherit the earth. I think that's the way Shakespeare saw his society working. Whether or not that's still the case is up to us to decide, I guess.
I am dying, Egypt, dying. Only I here importune a while, until of many thousand kisses, the poor last I lay upon thy lips.
The stroke of death is as a lover's pinch, which hurts and is desired.
On RN, this is part one of the series Great Lovers. I'm Amanda Smith, and right now, Antony and Cleopatra are the lovers in the spotlight. Shakespeare's historical source for his Antony and Cleopatra was Plutarch's Life of Mark Antony. Plutarch wrote it at around the end of the 1st century AD, so some 130 years after Antony and Cleopatra died. Plutarch actually wrote a whole series of biographical portraits of famous Romans and Greeks. And although he himself was Greek, he was a very enthusiastic Roman imperialist, which is why, according to the classic scholar Dennis Prior, Plutarch was concerned to make his account of Antony and Cleopatra a ripping yarn, not of great love, but of great folly.
Well, he loved telling stories, he's a great anecdotalist, but major concern is his concern with moral history. Moral history, the Romans were very moral. He lived in a time when the okay thing to be, if you were a good Roman citizen, was a Stoic. And of course, Antony is the least Stoic of people one can imagine.
So what view of Antony and Cleopatra and their love affair does Plutarch have?
That it's one in a series of massive serial fornication by Antony. There was his trouble with his wife, and then he had twins by two different women, including Cleopatra. And he is condemned rigidly.
Well, I think that Plutarch sees the greatness of Rome as embodied in Octavius, who becomes Augustus Caesar after he defeats Antony at the Battle of Actium. So for Plutarch, Antony is what? Not a great Roman like Octavius because Antony is distracted by love, which is a folly?
Yes, love is a folly. It is a side issue. It's never a thing that should concern a good Roman. If you want quick love, you go down to the slave quarters. You buy a slave. Or, more importantly, you are concerned with marriage and dynasty and family connections. So you marry upwards and you maintain the connections. It's very like the mafia. It's the connections that matters. Plutarch could be very happy with the Sopranos.
So what's behind Plutarch's view of Cleopatra? I mean, there's certainly a fascination he has with her, but why does he paint her liaison with Antony as, above all other things, devious and strategic?
Because I think he thinks politically, and he knows that Antony was not the first, because there was Julius Caesar, of course. She was working her way through the Roman establishment. But he is fascinated by her many abilities and her courage, as well as her beauty. And this exotic thing, because good Romans didn't see much of the exotic. And here was another world, the world of North Africa. And there's also this sense that it's a very dangerous area because that's where all Rome's troubles come from.
And in fact, the Romans really do fear Cleopatra, and she's a threat, isn't she? So
she's
they paint
threat.
Her in a bad light because she's a threat.
Yes, because she's a queen. And the one thing that no Roman can stand is the idea of bringing back a king, to say nothing of a queen. That would be a double miss to have a queen. So the idea that she might be brought back to Rome and adorn Antony's triumph and be apparent as a major figure in Roman politics is something utterly unthinkable, particularly again for Plutarch, writing at a time long after the Augustan moral Reformation, which he had attempted to persuade Romans to marry decent Roman girls and not whore around with all sorts of foreign women.
Dennis Prior and the Roman Standard on Love. But to return to Shakespeare's take on Antony and Cleopatra with actor and director John Bell. So, John, by the time they get together as lovers, Antony and Cleopatra have already been around the block a few times. they are middle-aged and they've got other things in their lives apart from each other. Does that give their relationship a richness and complexity and a kind of reality that we can relate to?
Oh, sure. I think it's an extremely troubling play, disturbing in its analysis of this affair, because it's quite unsentimental, quite relentless in showing this relationship, which is at one moment a grand passion, wonderful exotic language and rhapsodic emotion. Then they betray each other, sell each other out, quarrel, fight, bitch at each other. I mean, it's frighteningly unsparing in terms of an observation of a middle-aged love affair.
Yeah, it sounds like the real thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, very close to the real thing, yeah.
Well, in directing this play, John, as you have, of course, done for the Bell Shakespeare Company, is it important to maintain this ambiguity of their relationship, to keep the emotional centre of the play kind of enigmatic?
Oh, I think more than that, it veers out of control like a meteor. It goes all over the place. And that is important to maintain that the audience is bewildered by this relationship. Where will it go next? As we watch, you know, open-mouthed at the sort of betrayals and cheating on each other that goes on in this relationship, and then the reconciliation and grand passion and suicides at the end, it's astonishing. And I think with Shakespeare, you don't apply everyday logic. You play each scene as it comes up for what it's worth. It's a bit like real life. There is you only trace the logic after it's all happened, but people's emotions and passions drive them in the most extraordinary and unpredictable way. And you can't pin Shakespeare down to sort of logical steps one after the other. It's all in flashes of lightning, as it were.
Is it a temptation, though, as a director, to want to make choices, to make either love or lust or ambition the overt motivation for either or both Antony and Cleopatra?
That's the challenge for the director and the actors involved, and why you'll find no two productions the same. The story is the same, the language is the same, but what drives the characters to say those things and do those things might be different according to the actor, actress, the director, and their particular interpretations. And that's the glory of Shakespeare. There are no closed doors. It's wide open. And he keeps asking the same questions, but how those questions are answered by each generation will vary according to the mores, the sensibilities of that generation. So, for instance, in the 19th century, no leading actress would play Cleopatra. She was too immoral. She was disgusting. She was a revolting person. Now, I think most great actresses would aspire to the part because we live in an age that is far more flexible and, open-eyed and less hypocritical about sexual matters. And so the play is right back in the arena again. But the play will be, subject to the sensibilities of the time it's played in.
Well, I'm interested in the moral view that audiences have taken of Antony and Cleopatra, as you're referring to. Mm. You know, there's that anecdote, maybe it's apocryphal, but it's where a 19th century English theatre-goer comes out of the play, a production of the play, and says something like, how very different from the life of our own dear queen, that dear queen being, of course, Queen Victoria.
I think that story is quite well authenticated. It's quite a famous story, so I think it must have happened, and would have been, I think, would have reflected very much the sensibilities of the time. Although, of course, the production then would have been so bowdlerised and heavily censored that it wouldn't be anything like the text we'd see played today, because people just found it too confronting, and the play in Victorian times was cut to ribbons, and it was a grand spectacle, but anything too kind of lush in the language would have been cut.
Do you think 20th century social movements and changes, particularly feminism, I suppose, has meant that we think differently of Cleopatra now?
Oh, certainly. And modern productions of Antony and Cleopatra do put her right back where she should be. You know, as a very driving force and a very responsible person. But I think in Shakespeare's time, that's how the play would have been seen too. After Shakespeare died, the theatres were closed down for about 40 years by the Puritans. There was no theatre in England at all, so that great tradition of theatre was totally wiped out and had to start again with the Restoration. And in the 18th century and 19th century, there was so much social hypocrisy that the plays weren't done in their full texts. They were heavily censored and rewritten to conform to the times. It's modern drama, and plays like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf that I think that have shaken that up and made us see that all that stuff's there in Shakespeare too, and to be brought out and played unapologetically. But certainly the feminist movement has been very influential on productions of Shakespeare, and the women in Shakespeare have regained their rightful status, I think, as demanding and driven and quite aggressive characters.
Well, in the end, John, are Antony and Cleopatra brought down by this indulgent infatuation, or are they elevated in death by transcendent love? I mean, what do you feel and what do you want audiences to feel about their deaths?
I think it's a bit like when you go to a gangster movie where you see, all these gangsters living glamorous lives and having great shootouts and swanking around in casinos and so on. And you think, how wonderful, how great to be like that. But of course, it can't last. They'll get their comeuppance, and they do. So it's a kind of vicarious enjoyment of somebody else's indulgence and passion and getting away with it, as long as they get caught in the end. Because when you walk out of the cinema or the theatre, our own lives are a little more mundane and less spectacular. But we feel reconciled to that. We can be sort of reassured that at least we're still alive and we'll see tomorrow, whereas the people who have had these grand passions and self-indulgent affairs pay for it in the end. So we're kind of having it both ways. I think we make characters in theatre our scapegoats. We can see them having these wonderful vicarious thrills on our behalf, as it were, and we can enjoy going on the ride with them, but we know that it can't last and that our lives aren't quite like that.
From the barge, a strange invisible perfume hits the sense of the adjacent wharfs. The city cast her people out upon her, and Antony, enthroned in the marketplace, did sit alone, whistling to the air, which, but for vacancy,
had gone to gaze on Cleopatra too and made a gap in nature. Upon her landing, Antony sent to her, invited her to supper. She replied, it should be better he became her guest, which she entreated. Our courteous Antony, whom ne'er the word of no woman heard speak, being barbered 10 times o'er, goes to the feast, and for his ordinary pays his heart for what his eyes eat only.
Now, I just want to get back to the love-lust thing between Antony and Cleopatra. I'm wondering if it shifts at all over the course of the play, and I'm thinking particularly of Antony's death here. That comes about because he thinks Cleopatra has betrayed him when she nicks off from the Battle of Actium.
Yeah.
She then sends word that she's killed herself, so he falls on his sword.
Mm-hmm.
Then he finds out she's lied to him and she's alive.
Yep.
But as he dies in her arms, he doesn't recriminate her at all. Now, that surely is an act of love.
Well, love, that word again, how do we define it? I think there's an understanding between them that they are kind of made for each other and that what they have between them is unique. They admire each other's spirit and courage. They know each other's faults and vices to a tittle. So they're terribly aware of each other. They can't kind of live without each other, and they can't live with each other. It's that old conundrum, I think. And I think Antony realises in the end he's been defeated by his own mistakes, his own foolishness, his own rashness. And he doesn't blame Cleopatra. He can't blame her because they're two of a kind. And however she's betrayed him, he's betrayed her just as easily when he went off and married Octavia as a political move. So I think that's why there's no recrimination. Whether or not it's love or simply acceptance, it's hard to say. Cleopatra makes an attempt to live on after him, but when she realises that she's going to be a captive in Rome and she's going to lose her empire and her family, then she decides on suicide. So again, it's a decision rather than a romantic impulse, I think, because they're both, as you said earlier, they're middle-aged, they've been around the block, they know how the world works. They don't throw away their lives foolishly, but when the time comes, they make a graceful exit.
Well, she makes a grand exit, a very theatrical one.
Oh, sure. As is becoming to her whole character, I think. She's always one for making a great exhibition.
Give me my robe. Put on my crown. I have immortal longings in me.
Now, unlike lots of other Shakespeare plays, Antony and Cleopatra has never really transferred successfully off the stage and onto the screen. But there is the Hollywood epic Cleopatra, although it doesn't follow the Shakespeare text at all. Cleopatra, the movie, has become known as both the most expensive film ever made and the biggest flop ever made, despite the hype that surrounded its premiere in 1963.
A turnout of 10,000 New Yorkers jams Broadway for the world premiere of Cleopatra. A spontaneous public demonstration confirming beyond the shadow of a doubt that Cleopatra, which stars Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, and Rex Harrison, is the most eagerly awaited motion picture ever conceived. Never before has such a multitude congregated for an opening night. People from all walks of life in a state of expectancy such as few other theatrical events have ever engendered.
Well, a very large part of the excitement around the opening of the movie Cleopatra was that Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton had fallen for each other while the film was being shot in Rome. Brett Farmer, a former lecturer in film history at Melbourne University, says it was a case of life imitating art, big time.
You know, it's often suggested that the Taylor-Burton affair was one of the epic romances of the 1960s, if, you know, not one of the epic romances of the late 20th century. And I think in large part it has to do with the rather extraordinary resonances which existed between their off-screen romance and the on-screen romance, the legendary on-screen romance that they were sort of charged to play between Antony and Cleopatra. as you and the rest of the world knows, Taylor and Burton met on the set of 20th Century Fox's mammoth epic production, Cleopatra, in the early 1960s, in 1962, the first half of 1962. And they were playing two legendary lovers, sort of Cleopatra and Antony, and apparently met and fell madly in love almost instantaneously. And I think much of the fascination then as now, indeed the fact that years later we still not only remember but still discuss the Taylor and Burton affair, had to do with that rather unique but very sort of evocative, very fertile merging of fantasy and reality. It was often sort of claimed in relation to Taylor, for example, that Cleopatra was a role that she was born to play.
The motion picture casting achievement of the year is about to become a recorded fact. The occasion? The Hollywood signing of the exotic Elizabeth for the most exotic role in her career. And the role Cleopatra, the most fascinating woman of history who exclaimed, "There's beggary in the love that can be reckoned." Whom Antony called, "My serpent of the Nile," of whom Shakespeare wrote, "Age cannot wither her, nor custom stale her infinite variety." What a role! And Liz is the gal to do it justice.
Now, at this time, Elizabeth Taylor had a reputation for being a femme fatale herself. She'd already had an excessive number of husbands. She was on to her fourth, Eddie Fisher, when she took up with Richard Burton on the set of Cleopatra.
He was a huge star, barely in her 30s, I think, by this stage. She'd only just sort of turned 30. Had already sort of clocked up her fourth husband, whom she had, of course, procured in enormously controversial circumstances. Fisher at the time was married to Debbie Reynolds, the darling of MGM musicals, who was the quintessential all-American girl next door. In comes Elizabeth Taylor, and she was sort of consequently cast, you know, something of an immoral Jezebel, a man-eater and a homewrecker.
Then she moves on to Richard Burton during the filming of Cleopatra, and that's a love affair that surely was itself as scandalous as the historical lovers that they were playing.
Absolutely. All and sundry were coming out with a moral position in relation to the affair. The Vatican came out with an official statement, as did sort of conservative senators on the floor of Congress in the United States, many arguing that their American visas should be revoked, that they were sort of a threat to traditional family values. So, yeah, it was enormously controversial and scandalous in much the same way as the original sort of historical romance between Antony and Cleopatra.
Well, playing these two great lovers in the overheated, volatile, sort of out-of-control atmosphere that was around the making of this film, you'd have to think that that would have been in itself conducive to lighting the flame between Burton and Taylor.
Oh, absolutely. Indeed, there's sort of some suggestion that the scene had pretty much been set before the two had even met. 20th Century Fox's publicity department, for example, tried to get the rumours going even before Taylor and Burton met on set. Both of them came with reputations. Taylor, as we suggested, with this notoriety for being something of a temptress queen herself. But equally, Burton came, whilst, you know, not at the time a superstar quite in the league of Taylor, nevertheless came with a reputation for being something of a womanizer himself. And by all accounts, Joseph Mankiewicz, the director, or at least the second director of Cleopatra, had a very fraught production history. But Joseph Mankiewicz famously quipped that electricity on set when the two were present was almost palpable, and he likened working with them to being in the presence of two tigers in a cage, that they were both sort of prowling around each other, eyeing each other off, and that their sort of hunger and lust was palpable.
All that I shall ever want to hold or look upon or be or have is here now with you.
Remember I want you to forget me, please.
Forget? How? I can never be more far away from you than this.
Is there a sense, Brett, do you think, in which Burton and Taylor continued to perform their relationship as Antony and Cleopatra?
Yes, it was inevitable to a certain extent, in as much as this was the originary trope, you know, in and through which their relationship was established. You know, their career was together, you know, their relationship, was nothing if not sort of scandalous for the whole decade or however long they were together. It was an enormously excessive relationship. You know, it was noted for carnalities of all type. They were not only great lovers, but they were great consumers of commodities, of jewels, leading an extravagant lifestyle, enormous sort of consumers of food and alcohol. And, you know, I think in that sense, for their entire period together, the relationship had an inescapable sort of cast of excess and extravagance and licentiousness.
After Cleopatra, that was released in 1963, Burton and Taylor did go on to star in 10 or so films together. Not many of them were that riveting, but as a pair they continued to be riveting. Why do you think they were so fascinating as a couple to the public?
Again, I think much of it, you know, has to do with the extraordinary mythological resonances of their relationship. But I think that Burton and Taylor helped to represent, and by so doing, helped to negotiate the changing conditions of sexuality, of heterosexuality, and the changing conditions of romance, which were emerging in the early 1960s. 1962, for example, the year Burton and Taylor get together, was the year that Helen Gurley Brown published Sex and the Single Girl, which told us that not only did good girls have sex outside of marriage, but they were enjoying it, and it could be quite empowering. In 1963, Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique. So there was a sense of sexual liberation. And I think that Taylor and Burton, and Taylor in particular, you know, helped to embody that at a certain level. I mean, here was a woman who was very aggressive, even predatory, arguably, in her sexuality, but who was empowered because of it.
On your knees.
You dare ask the proconsul of Rome?
I asked it of Julius Caesar. I demand it of you.
Well, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton famously got married and got divorced twice. As far as celebrity relationships go, though, they particularly seem deserving of the title Great Lovers, who played out their relationship as Antony and Cleopatra and as Martha and George in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I mean, absolutely. It's almost as if great romance and great sort of eroticism, you know, is somehow diametrically opposed to enduring wedded bliss. The stable, enduring couple is somehow the antithesis of the great all-consuming passion. And particularly given, you know, I think it's overdetermined in the case of Taylor and Burton, given the way in which, as I've sort of suggested, that they were at least at one level charged with offering a radically different model to that notion, and that if they did somehow just sail off into the 1960s in sort of stable, you know, suburban bourgeois marriage, that it would have somehow been a rather sort of unseemly fate for what started off as a great sort of volatile love affair.
Music from the Hollywood movie Cleopatra, the notorious film that notoriously brought Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor together as real and imaginary lovers. And speaking about them, Brett Farmer, formerly of the Cultural Studies program at the University of Melbourne. I'm Amanda Smith, and on RN, this is Great Lovers.
Thank you.
beautiful Dido's Lament from Henry Purcell's opera Dido and Aeneas. And it's to this pair of lovers that we now turn. The story is told by Virgil in the Aeneid. Virgil started writing the Aeneid in 30 BC as the Roman Empire dawned under Augustus Caesar. The Aeneid is really a tribute to Augustus and to the glory of his empire. It tells the mythological story of the origins of the Roman people, going way back to the fall of Troy. Aeneas is a Trojan hero whose destiny is to found the western land, Hesperia, which becomes Rome. The mission is threatened, though, when Aeneas is shipwrecked and meets Dido, the queen of Carthage. To the Romans, she's a woman who, as Dennis Pryor notes, bears more than a passing resemblance to Cleopatra.
Dido's a foreign woman who gets in the way. And you see, she's not only a foreign woman, she's the worst of foreign women. She comes from North Africa. And here is Aeneas, who is shipwrecked in North Africa and meets this incredible woman who has set about building a city, and she is building a city. She is doing what it is Aeneas' destiny to do. And she's done it first, and he envies her, and he falls for her. And, of course, two goddesses start interfering in this whole business.
And they fall madly in love.
As a result of a thunderstorm while hunting. Always a dangerous thing to be near a cave in a thunderstorm when you've been hunting. And then it happened. And it's a question of that he interpreted it as a love affair, she as a marriage. And that is the moral issue in Book 4 of the Aeneid.
Well, whereas Antony succumbs to Cleopatra's charms and throws everything away for love of her, Aeneas spurns Dido. Why is that?
Because he's under instructions. He's a man of destiny, and he receives news from heaven that this is not for you, get moving, leave. And he is such a man of pietas, of doing his duty. His duty is to found Hesperia, the western land, not the North African land. He's got to form Hesperia, and he is reminded of his destiny by countless prophecies during his many voyages. And he spurns, there's this terrible final argument they have, where he ends the argument by saying, look, I've got to go to Hesperia, Hikama, this is my love, Hyc Patria, that's my country, I can't stay here. She takes it very badly.
Indeed she does. And Aeneas sails away from his relationship with Dido, and he sails away pretty much scot-free and on to his noble future, while she is utterly bereft and ruined, and she kills herself. And nowadays, I think, under the influence of Romanticism, we tend to see Aeneas' treatment of Dido as pretty shabby. You know, we do feel that he left her to die broken-hearted.
Well, of course, the 19th century commentators were most cutting about Aeneas' performance. They say, in response to a speech of overpowering passion, he replies in the accents of a cad. No chap would treat a gel in that way. And it's lovely how different attitudes get into the commentaries from different periods.
But how would that scenario have been viewed through Roman eyes, Dennis? What would Virgil's audience have thought of that?
Virgil's audience would have said, good on you, about time you got away from that nasty foreign cow, and we can't have that sort of thing for a good Roman. And Aeneas himself sets sail as a man of destiny. And for the Roman audience, for Virgil, this is very okay. They don't have any nonsense of romantic love. That's a much more modern idea. They have a strong sense of the potency of amor, that it can destroy people.
Well, the last words that Dido speaks before she kills herself as Aeneas is sailing away are quite vindictive. She calls him the heartless Trojan and she curses him. So is Virgil's portrait of Dido at this point as a vengeful and angry, spurned woman, is that so as to transfer sympathy away from her tragic love and back to Aeneas' heroic mission?
It could be. You never quite know with Virgil, because on the one hand he's a great imperialist and so on, and a great militarist, but on the other hand you find tucked into it notes of a different kind of sensibility than the ordinary Roman thing, though he has to do the right thing by his Roman audience and Augustus, for whom he's writing it, and so on. He also has a fine sense of the dramatic. And after all, if you can have a woman killing herself on the pyre like this, you've got to give her a good, tearing farewell speech. It's no good saying, sorry, darling, it might have been. It's not like that. It's not like Brief Encounter. It's a passionate woman. And it also enables him to plant in a Roman audience the idea that she says, an avenger will arise from my bones. And that avenger, of course, every Roman would say, ah, that's Hannibal. That's the Carthaginian attack on Rome. She's responsible for this, this curse.
Well, those last words of Dido before she kills herself in the Aeneid, you know, Aeneas, you're a cruel bastard and I hope you have a horrible life. This is very different to later treatments of the story. For example, there's the Purcell opera of Dido and Aeneas that's written in the late 17th century, where Dido's last words in that opera become, when I am laid in earth, may my wrongs create no trouble. Remember me, but forget my fate. Dido's last words before she throws herself on the funeral pyre in Purcell's 17th century opera Dido and Aeneas. Now, belonging to a later age and a different sensibility, that is a much more romanticised portrait of Dido than Virgil?
This is the sentimentalism of opera. Opera loves that sort of sentimentality, and we love opera for that. But a Roman would say, what are you talking about? It doesn't work. It's a terrible cop-out, the fact of being very gentle with him in the end, whereas Virgil makes no doubt, because he has Aeneas meet Dido in the underworld, and she cuts him dead and walks away from him.
Well, this theme of the man of duty and destiny falling in love with the wrong woman, usually a foreigner, is actually quite a powerful and enduring one. And I'm thinking here of, in relation to the great crisis and scandal in the British monarchy of the 20th century, King Edward VIII and Mrs. Wallace Simpson.
At long last, I am able to say a few words of my own. I have never wanted to withhold anything. But you must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love.
Now, what would the Romans have made of Edward giving it all away for the woman I love?
They would have said, what a Charlie, they would have said. They would have said, how absurd. This man has no sense of his duty, no sense whatever. And duty is what matters to a Roman. And Edward VIII had no sense of duty at all.
Just like Mark Antony, in Roman eyes and in Shakespeare's language, the triple pillar of the world transformed into a strumpet's fool. In this first of the Great Lovers series, I was speaking with the now late classic scholar Dennis Pryor. Also John Bell, founding artistic director of the Bell Shakespeare Company, Brett Farmer, whose subject is cinema history and theory, Mary Evans, the author of Love, an Unromantic Discussion, and the philosopher John Armstrong. Tomorrow, for part two of Great Lovers, we move to medieval France, where there's a major shift in the story of romance in the Western world. It's the invention of courtly love.
The great thing about courtly love is that it is ennobling for the lover. Once the lover is struck by the arrows of love, his behaviour suddenly and dramatically improves. He starts to pay much more attention to his clothes. He starts to compose songs, poems in honour of his lady. He cleans his fingernails. He's much more valiant in the battlefield. He becomes a much more civilised subject. So we have still, even in our own era, that idea that love will somehow make a difference, that love will somehow rescue us, that it will transform us, that our life is different now from what it was before we met that person. That's what directly derives from courtly love, the sense that it will transform your life in some way.
Also tomorrow, the French love affair of the 12th century, Héloïse and Abelard, a student-teacher relationship full of love and sex and romance, until Héloïse's uncle Fulbert discovers what they're up to.
Fulbert has thugs castrate Abelard.
Abelard retreats into a monastery, Héloïse is also sent into religious orders, and they write each other letters.
This was the biggest scandal of the 12th century. I mean, there are perhaps other. The Clinton scandal might be one, the Lewinsky, but I'm afraid they have no match in terms of intellectual power, I have to say, for this situation.
Love in the 12th century. That's next on Great Lovers, tomorrow, here on RN. Technical producer is Carey Dell. I'm Amanda Smith.